KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder used to be viewed by scientists as a problem primarily afflicting children. No more. We'll find out all about ADHD in both children and adults in the hour ahead, and we'll look at what is being done to help those who suffer from it with your calls and emails right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. About 8% of American children, that's roughly 4.5 million, have been diagnosed as having attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. It used to be believed that children who had it could grow out of it, but it has become increasingly clear that about half who have it do not, and increasingly it's being recognized as a problem in adults, both men and women. Currently, some 8 million adults in the United States are believed to have it and is now believed to be a genetic or biologically inherited disorder, a neurological condition that can be reduced via effective treatment. Studies also reveal that about 3/4 of the risk of developing ADHD is genetic, but some 70 to 80% who have the disorder appear to improve on medication. There are 3 subsets of the condition: predominantly hyperactive impulsive, predominantly inattentive, and a combination of those two. And as I said to our guest before going on the air, we could do a whole hour just on what's called the symptom continuum. But we're going to find out all about ADHD this hour and ways of diagnosing and treating it. And let me tell you who is joining us for the hour. Stephen Hinshaw is PhD, professor and chair of the Department of Psychology at UC Berkeley, longtime investigator of ADHD in children, adolescents, and now adults. His latest book is called The Mark of Shame, Stigma of Mental Illness, and an Agenda for Change. And welcome, Stephen Hinshaw.
Thank you.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Gina Pera here in studio, a journalist who's writing a book for the Partners of Adults with ADHD called Is It You, Me, or Adult ADD? The Surprising Link Between Your Roller Coaster Relationship and Attention Deficit Disorder. Welcome, Gina Pera.
Thank you, Michael.
Margaret Cochran is with us as well. She's a psychotherapist, PhD, runs a monthly podcast called A Mental Health Moment, and we welcome you. Good morning.
Good morning.
And joining us by phone this morning is Lou Mills, who's a PhD in MFT, marriage and family therapist, who works with adults with ADHD in San Diego and has had ADHD his whole life, really. Lou Mills, welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. I'm going to begin with Professor Hinshaw here in studio, kind of to get an overview. And what we're finding out recently, well, let's go back. This is a new, kind of a new name for an old condition, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, the real cause of ADHD is the same as the cause of learning disabilities, which is compulsory education. And I say that somewhat tongue-in-cheek. The genes that help us pay attention or causes difficulties in impulse control and paying attention have been around for tens of thousands of years. But we didn't really notice them too much as society until we did something interesting, which was make kids sit in chairs and learn to read. So when the culture changes, the genes that we're born with may get put to the test. ADHD used to be called minimal brain dysfunction, hyperkinesis, hyperactivity. ADHD is a new name for something that's been around probably for as long as we've been a species, but really became noticed about 150 years ago when compulsory education came to the fore.
Became also a lot more noticed in 1990 when a federal special education law came into effect. And in fact, some see the rise in numbers perhaps even consonant with that.
The first federal Special Education Act was passed in 75, and it was reauthorized as IDEA in 1990. And intriguingly, that set of reauthorizations put ADHD as one of the other health-impaired conditions that could get special ed services. And the biggest single year of rise in the diagnostic prevalence of ADHD in the country came in 1991, the next year.
It's a similar thing with autism.
It's very similar with autism. When it's a diagnosis that can get you services, people tend to make that diagnosis.
So this has become global. This has become something certainly that we're much more acutely aware of. And this has become, to a much greater extent, diagnosed than previously. And one has to ask, of course, the question, you may have even seen that Sopranos episode where he takes his son into the principal's office and the principal says, well, it's obvious he has ADHD. He's fidgeting, and Tony and, you know, deadpan, fidgeting? You know? I mean, there are a lot of symptoms here.
There's a lot of symptoms here, and it's the symptoms of ADHD are really the symptoms of young childhood. with autism, you can interact with a child with this condition, and pretty quickly you know this child has some very atypical symptoms. With ADHD, all 2-, 3-, and 4-year-olds have problems paying attention and showing impulse control. The question is, at a given age, what is too much? When is the normal variation over into the diagnostic range? And it involves some judgment, but it also involves doing a thorough assessment that rules out neurological conditions, rules out just normal childhood, rules out being abused, and rules in there is a lifelong pattern of symptoms that really get this kid, and then later adolescent and adult, in pretty serious trouble.
These assessments, in your judgment, are really gold standard, I mean, in terms of determining?
Well, we don't yet have a brain scan or a blood test that says objectively there's ADHD or not. These symptoms exist on a continuum. It's a lot like blood pressure. What's the definition of hypertension? We doubled the rate of hypertension in men in the United States in 2003 because the American Cardiological Association changed the criteria, and it lowered it so that more men would get picked up early on. The symptoms of ADHD exist on a continuum. The criteria we have now are the best guess as to when you're above that threshold, you're going to have real problems in school. You're going to have problems with accidental injury, both preschoolers and adults and cars, high rates of accidents, and you're going to have problems in interpersonal relationships across the lifespan. We need to correlate these symptom checklists with brain scans and other brain science that we're doing now so that we can make the diagnosis more objectively, but it's still going to take looking at the person in context. The problem with the brain scan diagnosis is many symptoms of ADHD abate when you're sitting one-on-one or not being challenged in a classroom or in an interpersonal setting like the work context.
Talking again with Stephen Hinshaw, who's professor and chair of the Department of Psychology at UC Berkeley and has a new book out called The Mark of Shame, Stigma of Mental Illness and an Agenda for Change. And speaking about agendas for change, medication and treatments have proved a good deal of efficacy. In fact, from the statistics I read, about half of the kids who have this disorder have been able to be mainstreamed in terms of classroom. So there's a lot of hope, at least, attached to what we're talking about here.
This is a very treatable condition. Is it curable? Depends on your definition of cure, but as you mentioned at the outset, the genetic risk for ADHD is strongly predictive of having these symptoms. But as with other conditions with a genetic basis, how the family responds and how the classroom teacher structures and how partners and employers create a supportive setting later on, that makes the biggest difference in outcome. Medications can be very effective. Behavioral treatments, and for adults, cognitive behavioral treatments, looking at your thinking patterns, anticipating situations differently, can also make a big difference. The problem with both of these treatments is that they both tend to dissipate when the last dose of medication is taken or when the last reward is given or the last therapy session is used up.
And as we know, with the Ritalin controversy, there are a lot of concerns about the medication.
There are side effects, as with any medication, usually manageable if there's careful monitoring. If I had to do one thing as a policy czar, I would say that we need to follow what the professional guidelines say. Seeing a kid, adolescent, or adult with ADHD every 6 months or year for a few minutes and casually writing a new prescription is not good enough. Our own major treatment study that was done across the country, the MTA study, showed very clearly monthly monitoring and very careful medical follow-up of medication makes a big difference in outcome.
Also, your study shows mostly in boys still, but harder for girls, and inattentiveness is characteristic often of girls. Now we're talking again about kids as opposed to this combined type that's higher in boys.
Right. Like autism, like many forms of learning disability, like early aggression, ADHD is more prevalent in boys. So for a long time, people thought it couldn't exist in girls. It certainly can, about a 3-to-1 boy-to-girl ratio. But the inattentive type, it's not as noticeable, not as rambunctious, may be closer to 2-to-1 or 1.5-to-1. And intriguingly, as we look at adult clinics around the country, it's closer to a 50-50 ratio of women to men coming in. Maybe women are just more admitting of the symptoms, but it may be that girls and women have a type or a form of ADHD that's more likely to persist over time.
And Stephen Hinshaw is professor and chair of the Department of Psychology at UC Berkeley. His latest book is The Mark of Shame, Stigma of Mental Illness, and an agenda for change. Gina Pera is a journalist writing a book for partners of adults with ADHD. In fact, she leads support groups and has a husband who has been diagnosed with ADHD, and the support group includes all kinds of relationships, including gay and lesbian relationships. I also want to say, just before we talk with Gina Pera, that if you're concerned about prevention with ADHD, probably a good idea in general, not to have alcohol or smoke cigarettes, because there's also evidence that these are contributory factors in terms of the toxic environment that goes on in terms of gestation and all of that. Gina Pera, I want to talk to you with some focus on relationships. I mean, this is something that really does affect the whole family, and so the whole family has to get involved in the process. I mean, from a therapeutic standpoint or from doing something about the problem.
Oh, definitely. It affects the whole family. And when you look at the genetic inheritance, if you have children, there's a good chance that one or two or all of your children, half your children, whatever the percentages are going to have ADHD too. So, and there have been studies showing that parents with ADHD who are not yet in treatment have more difficulties not only parenting children without ADHD, but especially children with ADHD, because they have trouble keeping themselves organized, and so they have even more trouble helping their children stay on track with school and getting to bed on time and that kind of thing.
And in many cases, when you talk about this wide range of symptoms, I mean, what can you tell parents that can be helpful in terms of really moving along the trajectory that's necessary to get a good diagnosis?
You mean parents or partners?
Let's talk about parents first and then partners.
So to get the child diagnosed,
To really be able to recognize that you've got something that you ought to go into the doctor's office or you ought to go into a psychologist or psychiatrist's office, yeah.
I'm not exactly the expert in that, but I know that if you read a few good books, read the MTA study that Dr. Henshaw has been so instrumental in giving us a standard for what good care is. Educate yourself first before you even think about getting an evaluation, because I might be misquoting this, Steve, but I think they found that with clinical standards, there's a 90% cessation of symptoms in children. But if left up to what's available in the community, the standard of care in the community, it's about 30%. Is that right?
Well, it's maybe not quite as high as 90%, but we found that with really well-delivered medication, and particularly when that was combined with parent management and school consultation and getting the kids skills in a summer camp program, when kids had that combination of really well-delivered treatments, nearly 70% got close to the normal range. With regular standard care in the community, even with the kids being on medication, and the standard of care in the community was about every 6 months for about 9 minutes, it was only about a quarter of the kids that got that level of improvement. So it's not just getting treatment, but it's getting good quality treatment and monitoring how well those treatments are working. That's the key to outcome.
Yeah, we could do a whole hour just on community care standards here. But
that is so important, because if you don't educate yourself first, if you're depending on the doctor or the therapist to tell you where to go, you can be led down a lot of spider holes. So if you even suspect your child or your partner has it, come to a support group. There's an organization called CHAD, which is very active in the Bay Area.
ChadNorCal.org,
CHAD of Northern California. And go and talk to other people and see what their experiences are with their children. You know, when did they know that their child really had ADHD?
But it's tougher in relationships, though, because most of the adults who have ADHD are not hyperactive to begin with.
Yes.
They can be certainly smart. They can be creative. They can be very productive, and often are.
They can be, and that's what fools you. And that's why, you know, I called my book, Is It You, Me, Your ADHD? Because you know your partner has strengths and talents. You know they're not, they are productive. They are smart, but they can do some really wacky things, and you don't understand it. You'll have a conversation, and you think that you've made an agreement, and then the next day your partner is completely contradicted the agreement and said, no, I never said that. No, you never said that.
I can hear people responding and saying, that goes on all the time, every relationship I've had.
Well, I know, and that's the thing. But, you know, and that's another reason. You know, you think, oh, well, he's under stress. He's drinking too much coffee. And back to what you're talking about, the risk factors, that's another reason I didn't suspect it in my husband at first, because for one thing, he was a very intelligent PhD scientist. I thought, well, that's just the way PhDs are. They're a little absent-minded professor-ish. But then also he was drinking a lot of coffee. He was eating a lot of carbs to get the pick-me-up in the morning. And I thought, well, he's not eating right. He has all these bad habits. But then after those bad habits finally stopped, then we saw, well, he's still this way. And he was, a lot of people with ADD will self-medicate, so-called, with these things, just trying to calm down their brain to feel better. You know, they'll smoke cigarettes. Nicotine is a very effective dopamine delivery system, so they'll smoke cigarettes. They'll drink alcohol.
We often call this type A personality.
We used to, but that was before we knew more about the brain. That was when we were just making observations. But, you know, the 1990s were called the decade of the brain, and that's when we learned this mysterious organ that, you know, we've never paid much attention to except in very esoteric psychoanalytic terms. We're learning more about it.
Well, let me go to Margaret Cochran, who's a psychotherapist and runs a monthly podcast called The Mental Health Moment and deals with ADHD on a fairly regular basis. Again, this continuum of symptoms can be very challenging, maybe even particularly for adults.
Yes, and frequently when I see people, they're undiagnosed. I'll often see them in relationship, for example, and they're having a great deal of difficulty in their marriage, being able to communicate, being able to be consistent. And as Gina points out, often they have had children, and we have an unmedicated person attempting to parent a child who has the same disorder. So you get a lot of, again, inconsistency and lack of follow-through, and that's very hard on the family overall. It's a disorder that affects not only families and couples, but also society as a whole. I mean, we see people with ADHD are twice as often represented in violent crimes as in the rest of the population. You see a 9-time greater increase in unwanted or unprepared for pregnancies. You see a 4% increase in sexually transmitted diseases with people with ADHD, and has to do with impulsivity and judgment.
In fact, the statistics are pretty grim as I look at them. More bankruptcy, more divorce, more accidents,
yes.
On the job and in
getting
traffic.
Fired a lot.
More addiction, too,
yes.
Of course. But it seems to me, I mean, a number of us were pretty hyper as kids, because you go back to looking at the tracing this disorder, you usually go back to about age 7 mm-hmm. as much as you can mm-hmm. from everything I've read. And yet, some of us were really hyperactive and yet, you know, managed to do the kinds of things that keep us focused. And
mm-hmm. some of us still are.
Yeah, right. And some of us still are, exactly the point. Again, determining where it begins and where to diagnose, it seems to me to be, in many cases, really quite challenging and formidable.
Well, there are two very, very important factors in my view. One of them is judgment. And, of course, judgment has to do with your place in your development. You know, judgment at 5 is different than judgment at 15, different than judgment at 25. But when you look at it compared to people who don't have ADHD and how that person fits in, that's kind of a big piece of diagnostic criteria. And the other is the person's ability to function socially. You know, people often think about treating children with ADHD to get them through school, quote unquote. But I'm much more concerned with their ability to get along with their peers, for their ability to communicate, to feel good about themselves. Because so often when you have ADHD, someone is on your tail. You forgot. Slow down. Why can't you just concentrate? I've seen you concentrate when you want to. Oh, my heavens, if I had a nickel for every time I've heard that one. And it's particularly frustrating because there's something in ADHD called hyperfocus. So it is a disorder of volitional attention. So not only do you have difficulty focusing your attention when you want to, sometimes if there's something that is interesting to you, you can get so hooked on it that it's difficult to take yourself off of that topic or thing.
Yeah, there's an example you use about kind of a wild example about some kids with a Coke bottle, and they decided
they
wanted to pee in a Coke bottle because they had a vendetta against some other kid.
And
the only kid who followed through was the kid who had ADHD.
Yep.
The reward was very strong, you know, and when there's a strong reward.
But then he got blamed for being racist because it was a black kid that they did this to, and, you know, it was a real imbroglio. It was a mess of a thing.
It was quite a mess.
There's a lot of misdiagnosis, though, and there's a lot of underdiagnosis and a lot of overdiagnosis. I mean, because there are many things that can be seen as being psychological disorders that are like ADHD.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And there are also comorbid or concomitant disorders. You can have attention deficit disorder and depression, for example. You can have attention deficit disorder.
The danger of that happening, in
fact,
to
yes,
a greater degree with ADHD.
Absolutely. Yeah. And a large percentage of people with ADHD also have concomitant anxiety. And there's also, of course, bipolar disorder. So, you know, being able to discern what kinds of things the person is dealing with. And a number of people who've come to me will have been given a diagnosis by another professional. But somehow or another, things just aren't working out, and their therapy's not working, and the medication's not quite right. And so when you do a little further investigation, you find that there's really more going on there.
I like this metaphor. One expert compares ADHD to an orchestra where all the musicians are well-trained and have good instruments, but the orchestra conductor, the executive function, is poor timing or is disorganized. The stimulant medication helps perk up the conductor so that he or she can keep the orchestra in time and in tune. Now, there are many of you probably who will take exception to the emphasis on medication. In fact, there was an article back in 2002 in Salon.com about a study that was done at Columbia University, which we may talk about in the course of the hour, where children didn't change so much, perhaps, as attitudes and management strategies. And as a result, there was a feeling that maybe psychostimulants were being promoted. And there is always that sense of the drug companies being, you know, behind use of drugs.
Can I say one thing about that, Michael? I'm sorry. Every day I am dealing with adults who have ADHD, with partners who have ADHD. There is so much suffering. This is the elephant in the room in the physician's office, where they're not seeing the relation to sleep apnea, to hypertension from untreated ADD, from sleep, from obesity and other eating disorders. We're talking about the therapist's office, where it's seen as passive aggression or even abuse, verbal abuse. The dangers of not being medicated weigh so much more heavily in my mind every day. Not on an abstract level, but on a very real level. You come, anyone that is skeptical about this, I invite you to come to a discussion group with either adults or the partners, and you talk to people about their lives before medication and after. And one real danger of this is that this creates stigma around medication, and it makes people ashamed to take medication and embarrassed to take it. And I think this is a human justice issue. This is a big piece of knowledge we have, and to deprive people of this right to make a considered choice is just wrong.
Gina Pera, again, is a journalist who works with people who suffer from ADHD and particularly focuses on relationships and has a book out called Is It You, Me, or Adult ADD? We're going to also talk with Lou Mills, and we'll find out about how medication has helped or perhaps, we'll get his response to it. He has been suffering since he's childhood from ADHD, and also now as a marriage and family therapist who works with adults with ADHD down in San Diego. But first, let me give out the phone number, because I know there are many of you who have questions and would like to join this discussion, questions as well as experiences, and that you can give us perhaps short and useful narrations about, maybe even having to do with your use or abuse of medication, or how it helped or didn't help or whatever. We're talking about ADHD, we're talking how to treat it, and we're talking also about the stigma of it, as well as the difficulty in diagnosing it and the whole diagnosis symptom continuum. Feel free to join us, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Lines are open and available to you. Again, it's toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also send us an email, and our email address is forum@kqed.org. With us in studio, in addition to Gina Pera, is Margaret Cochran, who is a psychotherapist and runs a monthly podcast, A Mental Health Moment, and Stephen Hinshaw, PhD, professor and chair of the Department of Psychology at UC Berkeley and longtime investigator of ADHD in children, adolescents, and now adults. And when we return, we'll have your calls and emails. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, prominent features, treatment, possible stigma, and we have a number of panelists with us. We're going to take your calls here shortly and bring you into the conversation along with your emails. But first, I want to go to Lou Mills, who is PhD and marriage and family therapist. He works with adults with ADHD down in Southern California in San Diego. And Lou Mills, thanks for joining us. Do we have you on the line?
Yeah, I'm right here.
I'm sorry. You didn't get your focus on something else there for a moment, did you?
No. I always say I like to talk about ADHD. I'm not too eager to demonstrate it.
Well, but, you've actually likened it to being in a wheelchair or being blind, which some people who are disabled with those kinds of things would perhaps take exception to, but it's that serious of a disorder in your mind.
Well, and I would never want to get into a contest over who suffers more, or you know, a kind of a self-pity, you know, thing about it. But I think people underestimate how debilitating it can be. And I've seen people in my office who are on disability who really can't work, can't get their lives together, who are just, you know, totally backed into a corner with their ADHD symptoms. And it's very painful for them when there are things in the media or, you know, jokes on TV or whatever about that trivialize ADHD, that see it as, you know, everybody does that, we all forget, and so on. So I think it is important to underline how serious it can be, and that it's a major health concern.
Well, your own personal history is certainly very revealing here because, as I understand it, I mean, you got a PhD in psychology and were having trouble getting through the dissertation and had something that you felt was afflicting you your whole life. And tell me if I have this wrong in terms of narrative summary, but you started weeping in an office with a therapist when you suddenly were told by him you feel nobody understands you. That kind of hit the key for you on the head, huh?
Well, yeah, and it was... I was in psychoanalysis, and it was really my last-ditch effort to figure out what was going on. One of the things for me, it was so frustrating not understanding why I was having trouble, and nobody else could understand why I was having trouble. So it was just like people are shaking their heads. What's the matter with Lou that he can't get it together? So I thought, at the time, I'm in training to be a therapist, and so I think that therapy is kind of the answer to everything.
What about medication is the answer? You've used it. What do you think?
Well, I started medication as I was finishing up my dissertation, and it took me a long time to get over my own sense of stigma about the diagnosis and so on and try it. And when I did, you know, my dissertation miraculously kind of wrapped up and passed my orals and was on with my life, it made a huge difference, and I sort of can't imagine how I would get by without it. I mean, I guess I'd go back to where I was being frustrated and perplexed.
Well, apropos of doing a dissertation, I mean, I think you've said that the biggest things to recognize here are the need to get organized and get things done, which so often can't be brought to fruition with somebody suffering this.
Well, right. One of the ways to understand ADHD is that you have problems with your working memory, the amount of stuff that you can hold in your head and, you know, manipulate your thoughts and so on to put into some organized kind of, you know, a paper or a project, whatever you're doing. And I was on something over 30 drafts of my dissertation where I would just get to where this isn't working and I would wrinkle it up and start over. If I had kept going without medication, I'm not sure how many more drafts I would have done before I gave up, of just not being able to pull it all together. And it seems like a simple thing, like why can't you just sit down and do that? But the brain won't go there, and the medication made that difference.
You also talked about waking up every morning with a sense of impending doom.
Well, this was you know, more in my childhood, but through my whole life, there was always a sense that I knew that something was going to mess up, that I was going to make some mistake or forget something or miss some important social cue, or, you know, there's a dozen things that can go wrong. And it, you know, it's not surprising to me that there's a large comorbidity with anxiety and depression with ADHD, because it's very anxiety-provoking to know or to not know, you know, what's going to happen today, what you're going to do wrong, what you're going to forget. You know, you're going to leave your wallet on the ground at a concert. I did that a couple of weeks ago. Just little things that make your life much more difficult.
Lou Mills with us from San Diego, again, is a marriage and family therapist who works with adults with ADHD down there and who has also suffered from it a great deal of his life. And Steve Hinshaw.
Well, there's so much heat and not enough light about this topic of medication and ADHD. And I'm going to go back to something I talked in the first half hour, which is an analogy to hypertension or high blood pressure. So I'm not saying ADHD is the same as that, but they're both on a continuum. We know that for a lot of people with borderline or somewhat high blood pressure, exercise and diet can make a huge difference in lifestyle change. But as you go up the continuum, as you get into really severe hypertension, you're probably going to have to take medication. We don't really cast aspersion on people who do that, but when it's a mental disorder, where we all know you really could control it if you just tried, and they're not real like physical disorders, then medication gets a huge stigma around
it. It's the American ethos of free will.
It really is.
Free will should be powerful and all-powerful, yeah.
That's right.
Well, Our listeners are all powerful in many instances. Let's go to them. Robert, you're on. Good morning.
Good morning. My name's Robert, and I have been diagnosed with ADHD, as has my wife. We are both successful working artists. Both of our sons have severe ADD, and this has been a source of great pain and hardship in our family. But I must take exception to the traditional Western medical thought that there's something wrong, therefore we will fix it using medication. We have tried everything under the sun. You name it, we have tried it. All of these medications, without exception, have such horrible side effects that it's rendered it impossible for us to have any relief from the medical community. The other thing I want to say is that there are so many famous artists, whether you're talking about Jackson Pollock or Ansel Adams, the list of historic figures who had this condition is very long. And often it occurs to me that, you know, these are people who survived and prospered with the condition. And so we've taken the approach where we are going to try to live with the condition and deal with it as human beings do, you know, by trying to live consistent with the disease. And furthermore, every time I used any kind of medication, I would be normal by, you know, cultural standards, but I would be making the worst art of my life.
You'd lose the edge, huh?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can look back at the last 5 years and pick out every single piece that was made under medication. They're nice, they're well executed, and they have absolutely no heart and certainly no soul.
Oh.
So I'd like to just suggest that there may be some other options other than going to the doctor and getting a drug for a quick fix.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Hinchcliffe.
Well, medication isn't for everyone. The range of outcomes is quite vast. Some people with ADHD, it's really night and day, and their lives are together for the first time. For others, it's a little bit helpful, but only in certain situations, only when the work is hard. When work is easy, it doesn't really matter much. Side effects can be an issue. They're usually managed, but some people, because of their genetic makeup, just can't tolerate the side effects. There are other alternatives. For kids, good old behavior modification, regular rewards and consequences, very positive, but also punishments and clear limits make a big difference. For adults, cognitive behavioral treatment, organizing, planning, learning the tools to shape your thinking can make a difference,
cognitive
too.
Cognitive therapy?
Cognitive behavioral therapy.
We just did a program on it. That's why I mentioned. Let me thank the call. I'm sorry, Robert, I said goodbye to him, and he was about to say something else. Maybe he can call back and tell us what that was.
But I just wanted to say something quickly, too, about
Stephen
this, the creativity and the focus and the edge. Many people with ADHD are quite creative. Some people aren't. Some people with bipolar disorder are quite creative. Some people aren't. We have to separate out the symptoms of a disorder that can be quite impairing from related kinds of features that can be an advantage. Many, if not most, artists with with bipolar disorder, talking about that for a minute, who get inspired in hypomanic periods, relish medication because that's the only time they can complete a project, and the suicide risk is so high without it. Many people with ADHD like the fast thinking that occurs without medication, but they can't complete a project without it. So it's an individual choice, a good long history, getting a proper diagnosis, and person making an informed choice. Sometimes it takes two or three different tries of medication before you find it works. Some people are philosophically opposed, and they're going to have to go to the alternatives.
But I think it's also very significant what he said.
Margaret
Cochran. He was talking about the pain in his family, the pain to himself. And this is a very powerful disorder. And there are a number of different pieces that you have to consider when you make a decision about what kind of therapy to pursue or even making a diagnosis. One of them is the level of ADHD that you have, because as we've talked about, it is on a continuum. The second is the kind of psychosocial stressors that you are exposed to. And the third is your intellect and your learning style. And you have to put all those pieces together before you make a decision about what kind of treatment is best for you and your family. as well as certainly the physiological response to medication.
Right. Just to go to more of your calls in a moment, but to stay with the idea of medication for a moment, here's Ethan, one of our listeners, who says, I've been struggling with ADHD for a great deal of my life and find the constant symptoms quite difficult. As I listen to the broadcast, I'm hearing a list of my basic personality traits. What I have found frustrating is that as an adult, when I have attempted to be diagnosed and treated, in many cases the doctors are likely to think I'm a drug seeker not willing to prescribe any medications, telling me this is a false syndrome and a syndrome of children. Is this due to the backlash against ADHD and the abuse of Ritalin and such drugs? And where can one go to be treated as an adult?
It's very difficult. Gina on Perry. The peninsula, I find that finding experts who are good at treating this are as rare as hen's teeth. I have maybe two physicians on the peninsula, and here we are, you know, with the bookends of UCSF and Stanford on the other end, and I am scrambling to find doctors who really understand this. And I am not surprised to hear this gentleman call in and say that he had horrible side effects from these medications.
Well, there are also people who can abuse what may be the accessibility of drugs by using ADHD. I think that's perhaps part of the problem as well. I mean, one has to figure that out.
That's a very gray area, because a lot of people, they start out with these medications. There's a lot of methamphetamine users that have ADHD, and they are just trying to feel right. They are just trying, you know, it's hard for us to know what it's like to be in the mind of someone with ADHD. It can be like a human pinball machine in the brain. And those medications stop, and they give them a calm, you know, whether it's illegal drugs, they'll give it a calm time.
You were going to say about Robert that,
I would not be surprised. Because, you know, for one thing, it's almost torture to send someone with ADHD to a physician who doesn't understand it and expect to get good treatment. So many times the doctors start out at too high a dosage, and then if there's side effects, then they'll say, double it. I mean, I hear this all the time, and that's one of my main focuses in the support groups, is to empower people with ADHD to question their physicians and to learn what the protocols are.
That's very important. Also need maybe some kind of consumer guide to physicians who are out there.
And yes.
Let me go to David next.
That's
David,
what the groups are for.
You're on the air. Good morning.
Hello?
Yes. Hi.
Hi. I was just going to respond. I'm a 25-year-old, and I found out I had ADHD probably, I think, my sophomore year of college. One of your experts said, I mean, it's been night and day, and life is so much better now that I have been prescribed a medication, and more importantly, found the medication that works. But, you know, to the people out there that do think it is not a real disease or a real affliction,
we're getting a terrible. It has nothing to do with this ADHD.
I think making a statement.
This is just a glitch in terms of wireless technology. You're going to say something, Stephen Hinshaw?
Well, just about medication. Let's face the fact: the stimulants, which are the mainstay of treatments for ADHD, can be drugs of abuse.
Absolutely.
And so they have to be prescribed carefully. If it's a very chaotic family. If parents have a history of drug abuse, we've had parents take the medications intended for their kids in studies we've done. It's also the case that you don't have to have ADHD to do it somewhat better on stimulant medications. How many college students out there, don't raise your hands, took stimulants to pull an all-nighter because you were too far behind in an exam?
Yes.
We know that many college students with ADHD who hate to be reminded of their ADHD, hate to take medication, give or sell the drug to their roommates who occasionally use it to pull all-nighters to study. So it is a social issue because these are drugs that can be drugs of abuse unless we really monitor their use carefully.
Yeah, we used to take something called No-Doze, and I don't even know what was in it, you know, but we took it.
No-Doze is sort of a lightweight stimulant.
It's a caffeine, I think.
Right.
Here's Suzanne, who says, thanks for the informative show. I've recently read about a new medication, maybe we can find out more about this, for ADHD that is some type of dopamine reuptake inhibitor. Know anything about this?
That's what they all are.
Well, the stimulants are dopamine reuptake inhibitors. We have a couple of newer medications that are selective norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, like atomoxetine, the trade name is Strattera, and one called Wellbutrin that really acts on both dopamine and norepinephrine. ADHD is not just one symptom. Like depression, like bipolar disorder, like schizophrenia, ADHD doesn't just exist in one part of the brain. There's probably several neurotransmitter systems involved. And what we now call ADHD, when we get it right a few decades down the road, we'll know it's five or six or eight different conditions that all look the same but probably have very different biological and genetic or prenatal predispositions.
I like your confidence in our neuroscience when we get it right, not if we get it right, and I think you're right about that.
I think it's really important to understand sometimes that people can go a long way in their lives before they get their diagnosis, and it's often confusing to them. For example, the first person that I diagnosed when I was a young therapist years ago was a physician. And he came to me because his wife was going to kill him and his staff were going nuts, you know, because he'd wander off and do this or that. And, you know.
And she had a contract out on
him? Well, very likely. I wouldn't be at all surprised. But, you know, when I started doing the history and questioning him, I said to him, you know, who gave you the stimulants in college? And he was silent. And then he said, how did you know about that? I said, because you graduated. And he, you know, of course, had a family history when he got into it. And I told him, you know, well, you have attention deficit disorder. We can treat that, you know, and it'll make a big difference for you. And he said, this is so embarrassing. I'm a doctor. I should have known that. And I said, no, you have it. You know, that's how can we go to other people.
Yeah, but what
just
I'm
to get out of perspective.
Assuming or inferring from what many of you said is a lot of doctors aren't really familiar. You know, one email said they think it's still in kids, that right. old myth and everything. But we get to something else here from Jonathan, an email down in San Carlos. He says, I hear Gina's plea not to stigmatize ADHD or medication or use medication to help. However, pretty much every kid or nearly every boy can be hyper and have a hard time focusing. What distinguishes a kid with a typical hyper behavior from one that needs medication?
Well, I thought we were talking about adults here. I feel like children get so much, the issue in children gets so much time.
Well, let's say the same thing about adults, though. I mean, adults can be very hyper, too, and yet don't necessarily require
medication. That's not it. A diagnosis is you have to have a certain number of symptoms from a very long list.
Going back to, again, early age.
Yeah. They're changing that now. It used to be, that's an arbitrary thing in the DSM, that it was age 7. Now, they find now that it might be age 16 or maybe after college. It depends on the supports you've gotten growing up. If you've had parents who have kept you in line or if you've gone to a school that's been very structured, the symptoms might not be noticeable until you get out on your own. And then you hit the wall.
And this is especially true for what we call the inattentive type,
yes.
where it's not rambunctious and the kids aren't hanging on light fixtures in the classroom.
Right.
If you look back, teachers will say, if only she concentrated more. And she could have tried harder, but it may not be till middle school or high school or the work world before we really find that the symptoms have become overwhelming.
And here's Nick who writes, I was diagnosed with ADD as I approached 40. Whilst this explains much of my life history, I'm now focused on leveraging my strengths and coping with the challenges caused by ADD through the guidance offered in great books such as Driven to Distraction and Delivered from Distraction. However, I'm wrestling with issues. A, seeking dialogue within my employer with the aim of developing a mutually more productive role versus my concern for being marked down as being of lower potential, and B, the challenge of considering a new, more suitable career while not risking my income for my family. And these are the kind of issues you see all the time, Gina Pera, in these support groups. You know?
And I would be, you know, I would tell people to be very cautious about approaching employers and saying, disclosing that you have ADHD. Because often, you know, with a lot of employers, no matter what it is, if you disclose you're any kind of liability, they're going to find a way to fire you. And most people think it's much better to focus on your own treatment and your own strategies, and not to mention the ADHD, but maybe to mention things to your employer that would help you be more productive, but not necessarily mention
frame
ADHD.
It carefully.
Yeah,
yeah. See,
very carefully.
I did a chat room online talk with about 100 people after my book on stigma, The Mark of Shame, came out early this year from the Washington Post. And literally about half of the these were adults who had mental disorders of various forms. About half said, best thing I ever did was tell my boss. I wouldn't have maybe done it at the first job interview, but once I got accommodations, it helped. And the other half said, don't ever tell your employer. You'll get fired. It'll never work. It's a divided issue. When do you disclose? I think it's all about timing. But to think that you have to hide this your whole life and pretend and cope on the sly when there are accommodations that employers can give and sometimes are mandated to give under the Americans with Disabilities Act is to just reinforce the shame and stigma that too often exists. But timing is everything. I think you don't just come out of the closet, so to speak, first time every time.
So is the individual situation, who your boss is and
That's
all
right.
that.
Yeah, it's all about being cautious.
More your calls. Alan, thanks for waiting. You're on. Morning.
Yes, Mike, I have a couple questions, two parts. My first part is my entire family pretty much has similar symptoms of ADHD, but my sister, who's 14, I'm 23, she's the only one that's actually been diagnosed with it. But we're all also very interested in video gaming. For instance, Saturday night, my dad stayed up entire night just to play football from preseason to national championship and got to bed just as my mom was getting up. Now, I also play the big one, World of Warcraft, which is highly addictive, but I've kind of gotten away from it a lot. So when you mentioned the hyperfocus, that really struck home with that. But how is video gaming affecting ADHD now since it's growing so large?
Well,
the other part is, do like head injuries and other, head trauma, does that affect the intensity of ADHD as well?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and you can find
that, yeah,
that a child or adolescent or an adult, often in a car accident, could be for young kids running out in front of a car, that the head injuries that are really caused or triggered by the impulsive ADHD symptoms then add to the symptoms. So you get a real vicious cycle where you get organic damage on top of these early symptoms.
And what about the first question with respect to video games? Do we know anything?
That's a huge problem in relationships, I can tell you. That's a huge problem.
You mean addiction to video games?
Yes. And it can go on all night. And the problem with video games is it's very immediately, you know, people with ADD respond to immediate rewards in the environment. That's one reason that positive reinforcement can work so well. And a video game is positive reinforcement. You feel good. They feel in the zone when they're playing video. And
well, I was just going to say, if you wanted to design a treatment for ADHD, very positive reinforcement, the level tailored exactly to where you are, color for stimuli, a video game is a pretty good treatment. And I'm saying
movement.
This, of course, tongue-in-cheek. Right. It can turn off the symptoms of lack of focus and turn them into hyperfocus really quickly, and it makes it difficult for usual interactions or usual teaching to match these sophisticated games we have going.
Right, and so they don't go to sleep, so they get sleep-deprived, and then they lose their job, and, oh, it was the pointy-headed boss. He just doesn't understand. He's so anal because he wants us to be at work at the same time every day. There's a lot of denial with ADHD, too. They just are doing what they think feels good, and they don't understand why the rest of the world doesn't.
And let me thank Alan for his call. You'll like this email. There are a bunch of emails here. I hope I can get to some of them. This is from Jim in Marin, who's 42, and says, if you had asked me a year ago, I would have told you that ADHD was bunk. At the same time, my marriage was suffering. I was years behind in filing my taxes. Clients in my consulting business were constantly complaining of my lateness and lack of follow-through. Last December, I was diagnosed with ADHD. I started medication. I started benefiting within hours. It was amazing. My marriage is stronger than ever. My business is growing. I have caught up on my financial responsibilities, and I look forward to a long and productive life. I can only say that if you even think you may have ADHD, please see a qualified professional and get tested. I'm sure that that's...
Hooray!
A little
hooray.
Focus goes a long way.
And we'll focus on more of your calls. Let's go next to Burlingame. Diane, you're on.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd like for the panel to address the issue of different cultures and the racial component, because one of the things that adults and children have to deal with in our overall culture is a perception of how race and culture enters into this. And the other part of that is getting help. A lot of times you go to professionals, and they have their own idea about how you're to deal with in your culture, and they have no idea about how your culture perceives ADHD. And they have no idea how the school system deals with, like, black kids or Asian kids or Latino kids. They have no idea. And what they're talking about has nothing to do with the reality that you're dealing with. Would you deal with those two things? Because what I'm hearing in this whole show is a very generic thing and nothing cultural or racially specific.
Well, Professor Hinshaw has done...
And that is a big part of what we have to deal with.
Understood. Professor Hinshaw has done some extensive studies. What did you come up with along the cultural or racial lines?
Well, let me just say that ADHD is a condition about which many myths exist. Well, it only exists in kids. Goes away when you hit puberty. It can't exist in girls. And it's really just a white middle class boy phenomena. All of those are untrue. We now know that ADHD exists across Eastern and Western and African and European and Northern and South American cultures. We know that it is sort of an equal opportunity condition. It exists in Asian American kids, African American kids, Hispanic kids. But how parents and teachers of different cultures respond probably has to do a lot with what the cultural mores are. We know that firm, clear parenting, giving the kids some slack sometimes, but setting those clear limits, makes a big difference. But we also know that even for kids without ADHD, clearer, harsher limits in African-American culture is associated with good outcomes in kids when it may be associated with aggressive behavior in white kids. So we have to tailor culturally competent treatments. We have to know what works, but realize that, again, ADHD exists not just in white middle-class society, not just in boys, not just in kids. And I really like the caller's comments.
And boy, with these numbers out there, it just goes to show how much we need better trained people in this field.
Yes.
Lou Mills, are you still with us?
Yeah.
Listener in San Jose, Scott, says, a moment ago, your guest from San Diego, Lou Mills, mentioned the idea of competition between disability groups. As someone who publishes daily on disability and who has spent more than 35 years using a wheelchair, let me assure you and your listeners that the majority of us with visible disabilities recognize the advantage that often gives us when seeking accommodation as compared to those with invisible disabilities.
I really appreciate his comment, and I think that is one of the problems with ADHD is that it's not visible, and people can dismiss it. The same way with kids, if the teacher says, well, I know he concentrates sometimes, it's that adds an extra hurdle for us. I appreciate that.
I also appreciate just a couple more emails here because we're running short on time. JC writes, when approaching my doctor about the possibility of having ADHD, I was met with a confusing answer. He told me that even if I did have the disorder, being diagnosed with it could be detrimental to my life because, as he said, your medical files are not as secure as you may think. Concern? Should be a concern, Stephen Hinshaw? You got seconds left
It shouldn't be a concern in a society that really accepted mental illness and that is deserving of treatment, but I think that's an overly cautious response by the doctor, but you got to be careful where your medical records go. It is true.
Well, I want to extend thanks to all of you for an hour that was really quite informative and enlightening on this subject. To put it mildly, we were talking with Lou Mills, marriage and family therapist who works with adults with ADHD in San Diego and suffered from it. Margaret Cochran, who also works with people suffering from ADHD. She's a psychotherapist and runs a monthly podcast, A Mental Health Moment. Thanks to Gina Pera, also with us in studio. Her book is called Is It You, Me, or Adult ADDD, The Surprising Link Between Your Roller Coaster Relationship and Attention Deficit Disorder. And Professor Stephen Hinshaw, professor and chair of the Department of Psychology at UC Berkeley. His book is The Mark of Shame, Stigma, Mental Illness, and an Agenda for Change. And again, you can go to the website, chadnorkel.org, and learn much more. Thanks to all of you, our listeners, to our producers. I'm Michael Krasny.
Support for the production of Forum is provided by the Louise and Claude Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation and the members of KQED Public Radio. Additional support for this hour of Forum is provided by the California Healthcare Foundation and calhealthreform.org, a new website for news, insight, and debate about statewide reform at calhealthreform.org.